Good afternoon. So today we're going to talk a little bit more about pipelining and hazards, and then we're going to start talking about our next topic, which is caching. So first, a logistical issue. So I made a minor update to HCLRS. You probably don't need to do it to get it, but it might help you. So there was a bug where if you assign to the output of a register, it wouldn't be an error. It should have been an error. You shouldn't do it, but it would have done something weird instead of giving you an error. So the update makes it an error rather than having it choose some random value for the output of the register. In this case, that example, YFOO. Also, there's the list of tests for Seek Homework and Pipe Homework 2, which is coming up, include poptest.io. Most people, you get that for free, but you might not. We don't actually care if you pass that test, so I removed it from the list. It deals with a kind of ambiguous case in the ISA about what pop RSP does, which of the two values you might imagine being written to RSP go, which we don't really care if you get that right. Okay, so speaking of talking about pipeline hazards, people did less well in the post quiz last week than I thought would happen. So I'm going to talk about a bunch of the post quiz questions. So one of them was about whether there were data hazards in some assembly snippets in our 5-stage pipeline processor. So in one case, there was not. And that was because there's no dependency here. So this first instruction, this RM of Q, it uses RCX and RDX. And yes, RDX appears in the second operand, but it doesn't actually write to either of those registers. So the add doesn't actually care what the RM of Q does. So there's no hazard because there's no dependency. There's no way for the pipeline to mess it up based on the register values. And the question asked about a 5-stage pipeline. And there was one question which had two NOPs between two adds. With our 4-stage pipeline that I introduced pipelining with, that was enough to make things work. But with a 5-stage pipeline, we're doing the read in the middle of the cycle that we're doing the write. And if you remember how a register file works, it waits till the rising edge of the clock before it writes. So the write won't happen in time, unless we do something special, which is going to be forwarding. So this was a hazard, because it wouldn't work without forwarding. So any questions about these hazards, whether there's a hazard or not? Yes?
So that one would work if there were 3 no-ops, right?
Yes, so if there were 3 no-ops, this would not be a hazard. But 2 is just not enough. And it would be different if we had a different pipeline too. So the second question asked about squashing the instruction currently in execute. So a way you can think about this is we have instructions A, B, C, D, and E in all our pipeline stages. And we want, during the next time, that the instructions in each pipeline stage don't include C. That's what squashing it means. We're suppressing it. It doesn't advance. It doesn't end up anywhere. And naturally, what would happen is that C would end up going to the memory stage. So the first thing you should think about is, if I don't want C to advance, it's going to advance to memory. I should do something to the memory stage in the next cycle, which is by making the pipeline registers that go between execute and memory do something. So the simplest solution is to set the bubble signal on that pipeline register so that where C would usually advance to the memory stage, that would make it not go there. And that's going to be sufficient to squash it. I also accepted an answer of saying you set that register to stall, though this has the additional effect of stalling the instruction in the memory stage. But it also happens to, unless if you don't do anything else, squash C because C doesn't appear anywhere in the next cycle. If you look at the other options, so if you set the decode to execute registers to stall, that definitely does not squash C. It keeps C in the pipeline. So Squashing means we want to cancel an instruction. It doesn't cancel it at all. It ensures that it's in the execute stage. And in fact, advances it here too. So we so this ends up being, in this case, C, and we have two copies of C. If you don't do anything else, if you don't make this normal, if you make this something else, you can be OK. And if you bubble, it doesn't affect whether or not C advances. You bubble in the code to execute. You need to bubble where C is going. So any questions about stall and bubble signals for squashing? So then we had a question about what happens during a mispredicted jump. So I didn't tell you it was mispredicted, but you're supposed to know that because our book and we lecture, we predicting branches as always taken. That was our policy. There's other ways we could have predicted them, but we chose always taken. We told you it wasn't taken, so you knew that there was a branch misprediction. And the question asked you what stage was, I believe, M remove Q in when the add was fetched. I think that's what it was? Yeah. So, or something similar. The way you figure out all variations of what stage is what in is by drawing a diagram like this. You might be able to do it without that. I cannot reliably do that. And the thing to remember about how jumps work is that we figure out whether the jump happens in execute. Why in execute? Because that's where our condition code registers are. That's where we've decided to read our condition codes. And after we read our condition codes, only then do we know what the right instruction to fetch is. So we, in the next cycle, we'll actually fetch the right instruction now that we've gotten that information. In the meanwhile, we spend two cycles fetching instructions that aren't the right things. Yes?
So the correct answer for that was when it was in write back? When the MR was
yes.
But is it in write now?
The MR move Q here is in write back when we're fetching add Q. It's in memory when we figure out the result of the jump. But that's not, when we figure it out, we assume that we've already spent too much time to immediately fetch it, because it's not a completely trivial operation to process the condition codes. Could imagine a processor where we assume that we don't care about making the fetch stage a little longer, and we assume processing the condition codes is simple, but that's not what we've assumed, not what our textbook assumes. And we had a last question, which was about what happens in a pipeline where we split up decode and write back into two stages. So we have this fancy register file, which takes an extra cycle to get the results. Rather than finishing in one, you need to wait till the next cycle for it to either write or read. And this changes how we have to handle hazards. So first part of the question asked, what if we just do stalling? So if we just do stalling, that means before we can read, in this case, RAX, that was written by the previous instruction, we need to wait for the second write-back stage to finish. So here we start the MR move queue, we start decoding and realize, oh, nope, value's not ready yet, and we keep trying and trying and trying until eventually the write has finished of the version of RAX we want to read. And so that takes 2, 3, 4, 5 extra cycles there. And we have a similar problem when we're writing for the value of RBX. And we end up waiting a whole bunch of extra time. In fact, I believe more than 10 cycles. So this makes sense, how you figure this out? So the second part of the question was asking, what if we do forwarding and stalling? We have the same thing. So in this case, for the I remove Q to M remove Q, we can forward. It's easy to forward because we know the value that's being written to REX basically immediately. It's from the instruction. Like, we don't even need to do the decode to figure it out. So that we can easily forward in time. For the execute stage, this is when M remove Q actually needs it. For the subtract, we need to wait for the memory stage of the M remove Q to finish. And after then, we can do the execute. So we need at least one cycle of stalling in order to make sure the execute is after the memory stage of the M remove Q. Yes?
So you're saying we just ignore whatever the decode stage is?
So the question is, what is the decode stage doing for SAP? So the decode stage, it's going to read RBX and RCX, and we're going to ignore the value of RBX it reads, but we are going to use the value of RCX it reads, unless there's something else going on that we need to forward to. So any questions about any of these quiz questions? These are, I would note, typical of the sorts of questions we might ask about pipelining on, say, an exam. So. Okay, so as I mentioned last time, we've ended up with a CPU where we have our five-stage pipeline, and most of the time we're doing one instruction a cycle, and we have just a few cases where we can't do that. We have the load use hazards, we have control hazards from conditional jumps, where we do branch prediction, but if we're wrong, we spend two cycles fetching things that we don't care about. And we have the case of return, where we have no idea what to even guess. How do we know where do we return to? I mean, we could guess the next instruction, but it's really not that. It's like pretty unlikely. So we have three cycles of stalling to wait for the memory stage to finish whenever we do a return. And we talked about how this would be different if we had a different pipeline. So, and I showed you an example of that from the quiz. So there's some other things that occur in real processors that we haven't dealt with in our pipeline so far. So one issue, which we're going to get into much more when we talk about caches, is multi-cycle memories. So our memories, we basically read in a single cycle. They take constant time, pretty much. You just read something and you get the result out in a predictable amount of time. And this is the ideal case for memories, is that we can build memories which normally act that way, that most of the time you read them and you get your result in a single cycle and everything works the way we described. But sometimes real memories are going to take longer. So this is a reason we might have to stall our pipeline in practice. So if we have a pipeline processor with one of these memories, most of the time it's going to work immediately. Sometimes it's going to tell us, sorry, I don't have an answer for you. I don't have a value to read, or I need more time to do this right. And in practice, this might take somewhere between 3 and, say, 400 plus cycles. Incredible amount of time. And so what that means when we have a slow memory, if we have these cache misses where our memory happens not to be fast, we're going to get something like this, where we stall the pipeline and everyone waits behind the memories. And so unlike all those sorts of stalling we've talked about so far, this is a kind of stalling we can't really predict. We don't actually know whether the memory is going to be fast or slow until we know what memory access is happening. With something like a load use hazard, yes, you have to look at the instructions to know what's happening, but you can just read the program without knowing what any of the data is or anything else about other parts of the program and say, we're going to stall here, we're not going to stall here. So we'll talk more about how caches work today, but this is the impact caches are going to have on our pipeline processor. Is that with a pipeline processor, if the cache doesn't work in the ideal way, which is going to happen some percentage of the time, hopefully a small percentage, we're going to get lots of stalling. And if you remember sort of the impact of things like returns on sort of effective cycles per instruction, this can be a pretty huge effect. In fact, is one of the biggest effects on actual processor performance out there. So the other thing is we've talked about sort of very simple pipelining. We always run all instructions one at a time through basically five-ish pipeline stages. And there are some things beyond this that real processors do. We're not going to talk about how you implement these things, because all these things I'm about to talk about are going to make handling hazards way, way, way more complicated. Which is the main reason we aren't going to go into the full details of how they work. So one thing real processors do is something called multiple issue. They issue, meaning start, more than one instruction per cycle. And conceptually, what you do this is you just make two copies of your pipeline with a shared register file with extra read and write ports and a shared memory somehow. With extra read and write ports, and you just issue pairs of instructions instead of single ones, or triples of instructions, and so on. And given this, you can get, instead of doing one instruction per cycle, in the ideal case, you can get like two or more instructions per cycle. So you could probably figure out how you'd implement this if you had that fancy register file and those fancy memories. And you would imagine that if you thought forwarding was complex, which it is, then forwarding in this is way harder, but still doable, just a lot more cases. And you also have to do stalling sometimes. Another thing modern processors do, which is considerably more confusing, is something called out-of-order execution. So our pipeline, if we have something like a load, an MR move queue, that's slow. I showed you earlier, what we do in our pipeline is we'd stall all the instructions behind it and have them wait until that finishes, and then we keep going on with the program. Real processors can do better than this. They instead find other instructions which don't depend on that and just do them, at least do the execution of them, in the middle. So in this case, we're waiting on this memory stage. We say, okay, we can't decode this yet because we don't have the result. We can't do the register read. So we'll do some other instructions. And in order to make this be still consistent, they delay the write back. So all the instructions do the write back stage in order. But you do forwarding between them, so you still manage to, get your sort of maximum speed you can get. So this is obviously very complicated to implement, and there's lots of things going on I'm not talking about. This is what real processors do. So real processors will try to find work to do when you have something like a cache miss, a slow memory thing. They'll look at what values the instructions actually need and look for instructions they can do. There's limits to this. But this is how sort of modern high-performance laptop and desktop processors work. So any questions about what's going on here? So when we talk about performance programming later in the semester, we'll talk not about how this is implemented, but how you can take advantage of knowing that this happens and not just pipelining. So another thing that real processors do that we didn't talk about is they do branch prediction, which is a bit smarter than what we're doing. Our branch prediction is we assume a branch is always taken. It's a very simple policy, but there are better things you can do. So real processors have incredibly complicated branch prediction, but there's some simple things that you could even implement that give better results than always taken. So one thing is you say forward branches aren't taken, and backward branches are. So forward means to a higher address. And the intuition here is that this makes all loop branches be predicted correctly. And loops are most of your branches, so this obviously isn't always right, but it's right a higher percentage of the time than the always taken policy. And actually, it does quite well in many real programs. note that this, like all our branch prediction things, is about typical programs. Like, it won't always be right. So another thing that real processors do is that they can predict RET. So we couldn't predict RET because we have no idea, like, where could we even return to. And the way real processors typically do this is that they have a sort of partial copy of the stack. When you do a call, they have this sort of bunch of registers in the processor, and they put the address that the call pushed on the stack to another place in the processor. And then they read from that and return. This place in the processor is going to be some CPU registers, and it's not going to have as much space as the real stack. So if we run out of space, what do? We just discard entries and make wrong guesses. It's branch prediction. If we predict wrong, we're still going to be correct. But when we don't run out of space, we'll be a lot faster. When we do, we're going to spend some cycles doing work we don't care about, but that's not a big deal. So this is something real processors will do. So real processors will predict returns in addition to conditional jumps. So they'll have no cases where they need to stall if everything goes right. So another thing real processors do, which we didn't discuss, is that they make predictions before fetch. So real processors often do not have the capability of waiting to fetch every instruction and figure out what its encoding is. This can be because they have a slower memory than the ones we've talked about. Maybe their ideal time for their memory is 2 cycles instead of 1. Or because the instruction encoding is very complicated, like in x86. So they need to do something that takes multiple cycles to figure out where the jumps are even. So to deal with this, they actually can predict branches before reading opcodes. That seems completely bizarre. You know, how would you do this? You don't even know what the instruction is. How do you predict branches? And the main way you do this is by having some extra data structure. So I talked about having like a copy of part of the stack that might not be accurate, but like helps you remember what recent calls did. You can have copies of the results of recent branches. So they have some data structure, which is some results of recent branches they look at. And they use this to figure out what instructions will probably do, even if they haven't fetched them yet. So at least if you've taken the branch in the past, it will remember it, even if it doesn't have the opcode in the pipeline right now. And because of this, real processors spend a surprising amount of space on branch prediction, and also caches. So we'll talk about these caches today. So this yellow square here is a cache. This orange square here is a cache. The red squares are the approximate locations of the registers on this processor. This is a microscope photo of a 2004 processor. 2004 because you can actually see the features on a microscope photo for a processor of that era, which is, you know, not as small as our current ones. And this blue part is the approximate area devoted to branch prediction. Note that that's bigger than the register files. So we've talked about a bunch of things with, you know, handling hazards where we have to wait for instructions to finish. For forwarding, we have to wait for the value to be available. We don't have to wait for it to go all the way down the pipeline, but we have to wait for it to be available. If not, we have to stall. For branch prediction, we have to predict correctly. If not, how many cycles we spend waiting depends on sort of how aggressive our pipeline is. So these are all cases where that latency penalty of pipelining matters. So even though we really only care about the number of instructions finished, we will finish less instructions because we're being more aggressive about using pipelining, because branch prediction doesn't always work, because forwarding doesn't always keep us from stalling, and so on. And this affects real processors. So around 2000, Intel came out with this processor called the Pentium 4. And when designing the Pentium 4, their philosophy was, you know, pipelining is great, and what we want to get as much pipelining as possible So what we're going to do is we're going to have lots and lots of pipeline stitches so we can make the clock cycle time really, really short. And this way, we're going to build the fastest processor out there. And they had a clock processor, which when they released it, had a 50% higher clock rate than all their competitors. Seems pretty good. It also had 2 to 3 times the pipeline stages. Counting pipeline stages is a little tricky, so that's why that's approximate, but it's something like 20 to 30 pipeline stages. And it was out of order, multiple issue, did all these tricks to find extra instructions to do, issued multiple instructions per cycle. And this was a quote from a review of the first generation of these chips. For today's buyer, the Pentium 4 simply doesn't make sense. It's slower than the competition in just about every area. It's more expensive. It also had required a particular kind of memory that was expensive at the time. People didn't like it. So it was slower. And it was slower not because the maximum performance, the ideal performance of the processor was bad, but because things like branch prediction and waiting on slow memories and stalling and dependencies made it so that 50% faster clock cycle time wasn't good enough. So they needed to wait until a later generation when they managed to get the clock cycle even smaller to be competitive in performance. And note that this is for typical programs. Like, there were some programs you could run which would be a lot faster. Programs which didn't have any data hazards would be. But typical programs, it didn't end up working out. Yeah?
We may have gone over this in a previous session. Like, how did the clock cycle set?
The question is, how do we set the clock cycle? What does it mean for them to achieve a 50% higher clock rate? So if you remember, we talked about the amount of time it takes values to propagate through each pipeline stage. So when you're designing a processor, you look at the hardware you're building and you say, you make an estimate for what's the worst case that this can handle. And you probably pad that a little because you don't want your processor breaking, because you aren't consistently manufacturing the transistors every time. But you make a number based on sort of what that worst path is. And that's how you set the clock cycle time. So in order to get a 50% higher clock rate, they were making their pipeline stages shorter and shorter as far as how much work each one did.
But like literally on the system, how is it like set? Like to like do like have one clock cycle be this amount of time?
So the question is, how does the hardware physically decide how big the clock cycle is? So on each chip, there is something which generates the clock signal. Okay. And that piece of hardware is often programmable and chooses the rate at which it generates each clock pulse. Okay, so that's what I'm going to say about pipelining. So we're going to, as I said, move on to caches. So I showed you this picture in a bit. So we're going to talk about the memory hierarchy. So memory hierarchy is about where we store data. And we have fast storage and slow storage. And on our processor, we have really fast storage. That's registers. So registers are a thing that, you know, we access all the time. They're the fastest things you can access. You know, every instruction needs to access them. Anyways, you can't do anything without accessing registers. And they're the fastest kind of memory we have. So these registers, they take up a little bit of space in the processor. And, you know, we can essentially access them as fast as we can do computation. So then we have our memories. And the way these work is we have an L1 cache. So this stores recently accessed data. And the L1 cache is going to be a bit slower than the registers. Like, we have to send an address, and it's going to take like at least a cycle to get a result out. It's not going to be like registers where we can access two of them at a time every instruction. And you notice that the L1 cache takes up a bunch more space of this processor. Then we have our, in this case, an L2 cache. So the L2 cache is even slower. It's slower. Why is it slower? Because it's bigger. It's basically the same as the L1 cache, but just bigger. But because it's bigger, signals have to go electrically through it. That takes time. It takes more time than it did with the L1 cache. And because it's bigger, you know, we needed to devote more space in the chip to it. And you may notice that, wow, this chip is spending all that space on caches. And in fact, most of this chip is space spent on caches, and this is typical of CPUs in the past couple decades. That most of the space on the chip is devoted to caches. It's devoted to getting the data to your instructions and having extra copies of that data. This is much more space than is actually devoted to doing computation. So on this processor, this is where floating point computations happen, and this is where integer computations happen. Everything else is either figuring out what instructions to run, or accessing memory, or accessing data. So, so then on a typical processor, in addition to this L2 cache, we'll have an L3 cache on most modern processors. They'll have another layer, which is even bigger than the L1. This is an old processor, so it didn't choose to do that. That wasn't a good design point at the time, and some current processors won't have an L3 cache. But you might have even more layers. And eventually, you have main memory. And main memory is outside the processor, typically. So this processor has this component here labeled the memory interface. So some wires are connected to that and go to something external to the processor that's a memory chip. That's what it communicates with to actually get values from memory. And you see that these have different sizes, and those sizes reflect sort of how much data they can store. And they also have, therefore, different access times. So our registers, we can access them typically in a modern processor less than a nanosecond, like one clock cycle. If it's more than a gigahertz, that's less than a nanosecond. L1 cache, as I said, is slower. It takes like about a nanosecond to access. L2 is usually around 5. If there's an L3, that's usually something around 20 nanoseconds. And main memory is like 100. So these numbers vary. That's why they're approximate. You can get slightly faster main memory, or you might choose to have a slower L2 cache for some reason, maybe to make it bigger. But these are the sorts of numbers you get. And this is partly because of their size. That's the biggest factor. It's also because we use different technologies to build them. So registers are built in a kind of memory which is less space efficient than, say, this L1, L2 cache here. So the L2 cache stores 1 megabyte in that space. These registers probably store only a couple kilobytes in, you know, space which is not proportional. So that L2 cache is 1 megabyte. Those red boxes that are registers probably store like a couple kilobytes. You know, if we were storing them the same way as the L2 cache, we'd expect them to be smaller. And main memory is even more compact than the L2 cache. So, as I said, our caches are what these memory boxes I've been showing you. So where I've shown you a data memory in our processor, that's really going to be our L1 cache. And in fact, it's going to be our L1 data cache. So this is going to explain the story of why we have an instruction memory and a data memory. They're going to be caches, and they're going to be separate caches. And basically, the way our cache is going to work is just like we said. We're going to have an address in, get a value out, we're going to choose whether or not to write, and we're going to maybe put an input if we're writing. And because the cache is variable speed, in order to accommodate that, we'll have some extra signal out of our data cache, which is going to be a ready signal. So that tells us, do we need to stall, or do you actually have the value I want, or did you finish the write I was trying to do? So we'd add that to our control logic and set up all the logic to do stalling based on that. And this L1 cache might speak to a second cache. That's typically how it'll work, and eventually the L2 cache will do something similar, and something will speak to memory. So the way you can think about this is that the CPU talks to the cache, says, hey, I'd like to read a value. The cache sometimes replies directly to that, and sometimes needs to forward that to the next level. So either to RAM or to the next level of cache. So the cache is our intermediary for talking to higher levels of memory. So either the cache has the value, so in this case, when the processor tries to read address 1234, it gets back a result without the cache going to memory. That means it had to have a copy inside it. When it asked for address ABCD, the cache needed to go to memory. So we needed to wait a little longer than if we were talking to memory directly. But we just talk to the cache, we never actually talk to memory ourselves. The cache is effectively memory as far as we're concerned. So the idea is that by replacing, talking to the memory directly with talking to this cache, we get a memory that basically has the performance of the smallest, fastest memory we can build. So most of the time, the ready output is, yes, I'm ready, I have your value. Things are great. And in addition to that, having this sort of fastest speed, we hopefully get the illusion of the capacity of the largest memory. Because the cache can go to the next level, which has a lot more space, we have the whole capacity of that main memory, which is maybe many gigabytes, or cache is probably tens of kilobytes, hundreds of kilobytes. And the idea is that as long as we hit in the cache enough, as long as our cache's small copy of data has the values often enough, which we'd like to be something like, given that main memory is like 100 nanoseconds and L1 cache is like 1, something like 99% of the time. So if we can manage that, if we somehow can manage to get a really high, what is called a hit rate, then we're going to have this illusion of the performance of the fastest memory, that basically every memory access is 1 nanosecond, the speed of that really, that small, not really small, but small L1 cache. But we're going to have the capacity of many gigabytes. So obviously, we can't do that in general. Like, I can make a program which tries to access all my gigabyte of memory. There's no way my cache is going to access that with the performance of this small memory that is smaller and therefore faster. Fortunately, real programs aren't so unfriendly. So we're going to depend on programs being well-behaved in order to get good results out of our caches. And these are our locality assumptions. And this is what makes caching possible. If our programs didn't exhibit this behavior, if all our programs accessed memory randomly, then caches wouldn't do anything. They would make our system slower. Why slower? Because we talk to the cache, it would check if it had the value, it usually wouldn't. It would talk to memory, and that extra hop would make things a little bit slower than talking to memory directly. But we're going to assume that we have things that let the cache know what to store. So one of these things is going to be temporal locality. So this is the property that if I access a value now, I'm likely to access it again soon. And based on this, if we think our programs have this property, we know that a cache should keep values we've accessed recently. And if they do that, they're going to have hits. So there's another type of locality we care about, which is spatial locality. This says if I access a value now, then adjacent values or otherwise nearby values, maybe not right next to it, but like two away or something like that, are going to be accessed again soon. And based on this principle, we should say that caches should store adjacent values at the same time as they store one value. So if you access a value, we should also get the values nearby it. And that's going to keep us from going to memory more as often. Yes?
So if you're like using a linked list and you're using malloc or new, does it give you like random memory, or would it take this into account and like kind of give you chunks that are next to each other?
So the question is, if you're using malloc, does malloc and you like allocate a linked list, does your program have good spatial locality? And as you mentioned, it depends on what malloc does. So malloc could just give you consecutive pieces of memory, or it could just choose random pieces of memory that are completely unrelated. And the answer is going to be it depends. Some mallocs will sometimes do that, some won't. I think usually it's convenient for malloc, at least the first time you're allocating things, to give you things right after another. But in a long-running program, it's probably not particularly likely. So yeah, so that would be an example where sometimes you'll have a good spatial locality, sometimes you won't. And this brings up an important point about how caches work, is that what program you write really impacts how good the cache is. Because you can choose to do things which will give you better or worse spatial locality. So to give some examples, so here's a loop. Loop is a classic example of why caching works well. So in the loop, we have good temporal locality in the instructions. People often forget about instructions, but we access instructions more often than we access the data memory. So it's actually very important that the cache for instructions works well. Possibly more important than that the data cache works well. So the machine code for this loop here is going to be have good temporal locality. We're going to access all the instructions in the loop repeatedly. So those instructions can stay in our cache, and if we keep them in the cache, those will all be hits. We don't have to go to memory. We also have good spatial locality. So the instruction that increments I is probably going to be right after the instruction that adds to total in memory. So that means if we load the instruction that adds to the total and the things next to it, will get for free the next instruction that runs. So this loop is going to have good spatial locality among those several instructions that need to implement the loop. Yes?
That was a question in the quiz, but it wasn't answered.
I can check the answer key. So the question is, the quiz seemed miskeyed for this. I will check the answer key after class rather than right now. So we also have locality in the data we're accessing. So all our variables here, total, I, and length, are accessed multiple times. These are probably actually in registers, so they don't like help the cache, but we have good performance because we can put them in registers. So this is something our compiler did rather than our caches did, if we generate good code for this. But they have good temporal locality. We access them repeatedly. And we access them repeatedly enough that our compilers figured out how to put them in registers, which is the fastest possible memory we have. And we also have good spatial locality. So even though we only access values once, so in the elements of values, we don't actually have good temporal locality. We have good spatial locality because we access values I plus 1 after we access values I. So if when I access values I, the cache loads values I plus 1 for me, it's going to get better performance. So we have this heuristic that we load values which are next to the one you're accessing. We'll still have a big benefit from caching here, even though the thing that's going to be accessed from the cache is only accessed once. So any questions about locality in this? So let's talk about building our cache up. How are we going to design our cache? So the first decision we need to make is, you know, I have some data to store recently accessed or nearby values, values which are going to take advantage of locality. And let's say in this case, I have 16 bytes to store that stuff. I need to figure out how am I going to organize that 16 bytes. And one decision I need to make is, what size values am I going to copy from memory? I could copy byte by byte, I could copy bit by bit, I could copy like just 16 bytes of memory, all together. I need to make a decision. I'm going to make a decision to store 2-byte chunks from memory. That means that what we're going to call my cache block is going to be 2 bytes. This is a decision I made, and we can think later about whether that was a good or bad decision. And in order to make it simple to figure out what part of memory is where, I'm going to divide up memory itself, this entire memory, into 2-byte segments. And I'm going to say that each of these things in the blocks in the cache, each of these 4 blocks, can store exactly one of these. So we're never, for example, going to store 1122 in one of these blocks. We're always going to store 0011 or 2233. So we're never going to misalign things. This is just going to make things simpler. We could imagine building something where we could store 1122, where we could have something where we, you know, look in the middle of these the 2-byte blocks of memory and store half and half and half in one cache block. But it's going to make things simpler if we just say we only take one of these blocks and store it each time. So if I just have this storage, and I'm implementing a cache, I get a request from the processor, hey, I'd like address 1. And if I get that, I look at the data I have there, I have a bunch of zeros, and I say, huh, I don't know if I have address 1. So we need something more. We need some way to know whether or not I have that address. No. So we read some byte. How do I know, you know, whether or not I have that? How do I know where do I look? Do I look at the whole thing or not? So to make things simple, because we want our cache to be fast, one decision we need to make is where am I going to look? Which of these values am I going to look when I get this address here that I need to read? And we're going to start with the simplest policy, the fastest one to implement, not the most flexible, called a direct map cache. So that's going to say I have 4 places to put things. I'm going to use exactly one of them for each address I read or write. There's only going to be one place I care about for any address. So I need some way to assign that. So I'm going to give each one an index from 0 to 3. And I'm going to say the first chunk of memory goes to index 0. The second one goes to index 1, and so on. Until I run out of indexes, then I wrap around. And we're doing that sort of consecutive wrapping around thing, so I can actually store as much contiguous memory as possible. So if I'm reading the first 4 bytes here, I want it to be possible to store all of them in the cache at the same time. That's good for spatial locality. So I'm spreading it out so I can store any block of 4 blocks of memory in the cache. And since I'm reading one particular address here, I know where to find. I can look at this address and know where I can find it. So in this case, this address here, 01011, is going to be here. And based on the decision I made about the first part of memory goes to block index 0, second goes to 1, 2, 3, then 0, 1, 2, 3, and so on, it ends up mapping to this to index 1, the second block in this picture. So that's the possible place it might be. But of course, I see zeros there, and I have no idea without going to memory whether or not that's the right value. Question?
Yeah, what exactly, I didn't really understand, but what exactly does the bytes represent? It's like the beginning and end of the, but what is the bytes column representing?
So the question is, what does the bytes column represent? So here, I'm saying that addresses 0 through 1 have these values. The first byte is 00, the second byte is 11. Addresses 1, 2 through 3 have these values. This first byte is 22, second byte is 33. That makes sense, what this picture is showing? So I'm just showing all the bytes of memory. I'm doing it in a way which corresponds to these blocks I'm storing in the cache. So here, I've decided on how, on this mapping of blocks of memory to places I might put things in the cache. But when I'm reading this value here, so I know where it might be in the cache. So I'm saying this address, which has here, ends up in this part of the cache. Okay, this is where it is. It belongs to this second block, index 1 of the cache. But I just see there's a bunch of zeros there. I have no idea whether or not that's something I can give to the processor. I can't just blindly give it to the processor because, well, it's not right. There's no reason that I have AABB stored there. So I'm going to need some way of knowing, first of all, do I even have any values stored here? So I have some bits in this 16 bytes of storage. 16 bytes of storage here. That is 8 bytes of storage, isn't it? 8 bytes of storage here. But I don't know whether or not they actually correspond to anything in memory. So those 0000, it could be the bytes of 0 to 1 or 8 through 9 and so on. But I don't know whether it's anything. So first, I need something to know, is that value I'm looking at when I'm reading, is it even anything? You know, I want to be reading this BB. Do I have a copy of it here? I don't know. So first I need to know, do I have a copy of anything? So I'm going to add this bit called a valid bit, which is going to tell me, hey, I know where I'm looking, but is that value actually anything? So in addition to that, when I do have a value here, when I don't have a value, I'm going to need to fetch it and store it in the cache. So let's say I've loaded these bytes AABB here. Now I have them stored, and now they're valid. So I'm still missing something. And the problem is that if I go later on and try to read, read a different value, I need to know where it came from. So in this case, based on the policy I have, I could have been storing this AABB here, could either be come from here, from bytes 1 to 2, 2 to 3 of memory, or from here, from 10 to 11. So I don't know that unless I store that information. Everything I need to know in order to tell the processor, here's your value, needs to be in the cache. So I need, in addition to having information about, hey, do I even have any value stored here, I need something we call a tag. And what the tag is going to be, it's going to tell us, where did I get this value from? So the simplest thing to do would just be to store the address we got it from. And that's basically what we're doing, but we're not actually storing the whole address. And the observation to make here is that is that in each bunch of blocks, only these top bits of the address change. This makes sense? So this is the first value we can store has 0, 0 in those top bits. The second value we could store here has 0, 1 in those top bits, and that's going to keep going. So only the top bits change because, it's only every in 8 bytes in this case that there's a value we could store in that part of the cache. And that's just because of how we decided what goes in each spot in the cache. So I only need to store those bits in order to know where this value come from. Everything else is implied by it's in this position, I decided what values can go there. So after I have all these things, this is what I get for my, what is called a direct map cache. So I have this policy that each of these blocks can store a value from exactly one set of places in memory. There's a unique place to look for any address. I have a valid bit to tell me, did I even put anything in this cache at all? Or are we starting from, fresh? Did we just boot up? And I have a tag to tell me, that value has stored there, where did it come from? Because there's several locations it could have come from. So I record the part of the address that could have that differs between the different options in the tag. So any questions so far on this layout? So we'll go through a little more systematic detail of how the cache lookup looks in a bit. So when we have a cache organized this way, as I said, we're going to have a bunch of data, we're going to have a tag and a valid bit. And what we're going to do is we're going to take our address and we're going to split it up into 3 pieces. So one piece is the piece which only changes based on where in a particular block of data we are. So in that case, this is 2 bits because there's in this cache, we store 4 bytes. So the bottom 2 bits of the address just say which of those 4 bytes is it. If we look at how things ended up here, each block here, you know, we had 0 and 1, 2 and 3. That bottom bit of the address didn't matter because we have blocks of 2 bytes. It didn't change where in the cache we look. So we're going to separate out those bottom bits. We don't need them yet. And then we use the next bits as what we call the index. So that tells us what row of the cache to look at. And the way these memories physically work, we're basically going to send that index to something, and we're going to get out all the values in the row from memory. So based on those values, we need to find out, first of all, do we have anything stored there? And secondly, is it the address I'm looking for? So what we're going to do is we're going to take the remaining bits of the address, the ones we aren't using to figure out where in the block it is and what line, what row of the cache we go to. That's the tag. And we're going to compare it to the value we just read out. And we're also going to check the valid bit in order to see, do we have any value there or is it just junk? And if those are both true, we have what's called a cache hit. That yes, in fact, based on our policy, based on how we organize this cache, this data here actually is the data I care about, the data that corresponds to that address. So then we take the offset, which tells us which of those 4 bytes that I just read does this address actually correspond to. So it was 00, that would be the first byte. You know, that would be the first part of the block. It was 01, it's the second part, and so on. So we just split up the data into those 4 bytes and choose which of those 4 bytes we give, assuming we're reading 1 byte at a time. Yes?
Do the blocks have to be 4 bytes?
So the question is, do the blocks have to be 4 bytes? No. So I started out with here, 2-byte blocks. And here I have 4-byte blocks. So how much you have in a block is going to change, of course, how big this offset is and also how big this mux is. How much you have, how many rows you have is going to change how big this index is. And anything left over is going to be the tag. So we have choices to make as a designer of hardware about what the sizes of all these things are. And this is a big issue when you're designing a processor, is figuring out what are good choices for all these sizes. So any questions, confusion about what's going on in this picture? So this is reading from a cache. So one thing I want you to be comfortable with is how we split up this address. So we have our 3 parts, our offset, which is if we have a block, how do we determine which byte of the block we care about? We have our index, which is if we have lots of rows of caches, lots of places to store values, how do we determine which row we care about? And we have our tag, which is everything else that's in the address, so we know, you know, so we can reconstruct the full address. So if I look at this byte B4 here, I know it's in the row with this index, so I know that part of the address. And I know it's the first thing, so I know it's offset 00. The tag is everything else. I need to figure out where it came from in memory. So we'd like you to, in general, be able to figure out how to split up addresses into these 3 components. How do I know what row of the cache I look in? How do I know what part of the block this value is in? So here's an exercise. So the general rule is going to be that if we have two-byte blocks, that means there are two possible places, implies 1 bit to choose. And that's the general principle you should use. So if we have 4 sets, that means there are 4 possible places. You need 2 bits to choose them. Choose which of the 4. And that's how you determine all the sizes here. So, for example, these two examples have 2-byte blocks. That means their offset is 1 bit, so it's the last bit of the address. You have one example here with a 4-byte block. That means the offset is 2 bits. Two choices. It's 4 choices means we need 2 bits. So that means that the offset is the last 2 bits of the address. If we have 4 sets, we need 2 bits to determine the index, which row we go to, which is the next part of the address. If we have 8 sets, we need 3 bits. And if we have 2, we need 1. And you can just take the next chunk off the address to divide it up. And everything left over is the tag. So note that when we combine the tag index and offset, in each of these cases, we get back the original address. Because then remember, the tag has to give us everything else that we care about for the address. And so by knowing how to do this, you can figure out where are things in the cache, and you can figure out what's the cache going to do. Given that you know what memory addresses we're accessing. So any questions about any of the numbers I have here? So our textbook presents this with a bunch of formulas, which is another fine way of thinking about it. But these formulas are basically encoding that idea. We have so many choices for rows, which in this case are sets. How many bits do we need to do that? It's encoding that principle that if we have 4 choices, we need 2 bits, and so on. That's just what these formulas do. We also have this notion of cache size. And note what this cache size is that it's based on the block size times the number of sets. That's the number of rows. So the cache size is, in this case, the cache size of this thing with 2-byte blocks and 8 sets is 16 bytes. This is even though we're storing more than 16 bytes of data here, because we have to store the tag and the valid bit. That extra information is not included when we talk about cache sizes. So if we have a 1 megabyte cache, that's 1 megabyte of actual values, but a bunch of extra stuff with tags and valid bits. So you can either reason about we have so many choices, we need this many bits, or you can just look up these formulas and memorize them. Either way, that's a valid way of figuring out what happens. So let's go through an example here. So I have a cache here with 4 sets, 4 rows, and 2-byte blocks. And I have this bunch of addresses which are accessed, and I eventually want to figure out which of these are going to be hits and misses, given that our cache starts empty. So first of all, if our cache starts empty, it has to get filled somehow. So how should we fill a cache? What should we do to write things in the cache? When should we put something in the cache? It's a good time to do that.
If you request something and it's not there?
Yeah, so if we request something, the principle of temporal locality says we're probably going to access it again, I should store it in the cache. Also, spatial locality says if I access 1 byte of the block, I'm probably going to access the other bytes of the block. So both of these principles say when you access something and it's not in the cache, you should add it to the cache. So that's how we're going to get stuff in the cache. So if I were to figure out what ends up being put in the cache here, and which of these accesses actually hit, and which of them are misses, where we have to get something from memory and maybe put it in the cache, the first step is going to be, how did this address get divided up? So I'm going to use either reasoning about there are this many choices, or use these formulas, which is says the same thing. So we have 4 sets. That means we need 2 set index bits. We have 2-byte blocks, that means we need 1-byte block offset bit. And remember, it's tag, then index, then offset. Offset's the least significant bit, so I can highlight the parts of my address like this. So the offset is that bottom bit, then we have 2 index bits, everything else must be the tag. So given this, I can reason about what's going to happen when I access this guy. So if we look at this first access, the index is 0, 0. That means we go to this thing labeled index 0, 0. That's the first set of the cache. And the value wasn't there before because it was invalid. So it didn't matter what the tag would be. And based on our policy, what we're going to do is we're going to store the value there, but the result's going to be a miss. It's going to be slow. We're going to go to memory. But as we get the value back from memory, we're going to put it in the cache just in case we access it again later. So then if you look at our next access here, we access address 1. We look at the index bits of that address. They're both zeros, so we go to this first index. And then we look at the tag and the valid bit. So the valid bit is true, so there's something there, but we don't know whether it's actually the thing that relates to address 1 or if it's some other address. So I look at that, and I say, okay, let's look at the tag. The tag is all zeros. I look at the address 1. Tag part of that address is all zeros, so it's a hit. And I can keep going through this access pattern to figure it out. So in the next access, I look at the index. It's 1. There's nothing there, so we add something to the cache. So it's a miss. And we fill in this with the tag part of the address and also the values from that part of memory. I look at the next access. It goes to index 0. I look at what was in index 0, and it has tag 0000. So even though it's valid, it's not this address. It's not address hex 61. And that means it's a miss. And our policy is that when we access something, we assume it's going to be accessed again soon. So since we assume that, whatever was there before wasn't accessed as soon, so it's not as important, and we're going to get rid of it, even though this might sometimes be wrong as far as best performance. Then we have an access to address hex 62. If we look in the cache, that's an index 1. That's what the index bits of the address. We check the tags, they match. So it must be storing that. And notice that both of these hits we have are not for the exact same address we accessed. They're examples of spatial locality. This is another one. We're accessing the other part of the block. And then we can keep going. So here, we access address 0 again. So that seems like an example of spatial locality, but if we look at address 0, it's an index 0, and just before we did the access, the tag doesn't match. There's something else stored there. In fact, its address is 60 through 61. So that's a miss. And just like our policy says, we're going to store the thing we just accessed there, replacing what was there before, even though it, you know, looked like it was useful to have it there, because we had some hits on that cache set. And we keep doing this until through our entire access pattern. So this is a very mechanical process, and this is how you can figure out what exactly a cache does. And how good the performance is. So the more hits, the better our performance is going to be. So each of these misses means our cache is going to be substantially slower. It means our processor is going to have to stall, which means that our program is going to run slower. So any questions about anything I did to figure this out? Okay. So one thing worth noting, and this is a disadvantage of this simplest kind of cache I've talked about, these direct map caches, is that we had a conflict miss. So that was, you know, we have extra space in the cache. We have this whole value here, block, that I'm not using, the valid bit 0. But we didn't look there because our policy is everything is stored in one place. That makes the cache faster, because we only need to look in one place. But it meant that even though I had extra space in my cache, because I accessed this unrelated looking thing, I cleared it from the cache and it wasn't a hit the second time I accessed address zero. So in a bit we'll talk about cache organizations that avoid this, but at the cost of being less efficient. So first, since hopefully you understood happening, so a couple exercises. So first, you know, I have a different cache here, 4-byte blocks and 4 sets. Four-byte blocks and 4 sets, which I just numbered wrong, obviously, because the sets. So first, how do we split up this address? So figure it out, write it down, quickly check with your neighbor into the tag, index, and offset. So who has an answer? Who has no idea what to do? A couple people. So one way of doing this is with the formulas in the corner. So the block offset is the bottom part of the address, and we need to figure out how many bits that is. So we're going to have, in general, remember, is that we're going to have the tag, then the index part of the address, bits of the address, then the offset. And this is going to be the block offset bits worth of bits. And this is going to be index bits and so on. And we have this formula here that you can just solve for to get the number of bits for the offset. So that would be the first step I would do. Someone want to, you guys? Yeah. So we have the block size is 4 bytes. That means that 2 to the something bytes, 2 to the something bytes, if that's our block size, then we have something block offset bits. So 2 to the 2 is 4, so we have 2 block offset bits. So that means the bottom 2 bits here is the block offset. That part which tells us which of the 4 bytes that it'll be in this value over here we're going to look at. So then we need to get the number of set index bits, because that's the next part. And the set index bits is going to be based on this formula. So we have some number of sets, that's the number of rows in this case. So we have 4, and we have 2 to the something is 4. That something is the number of set index bits. So again, it's 2. So we have 2 set index bits. And the policy is everything else is the tag. So we end up splitting the address up like this. Okay. So I was going to ask you to figure out how many are hits, but that is not something we can do in 1 minute. We will start with that next time.